This is fantastic, this difference. And that story just got into me, and I said, when Johnson Fairchild asked me to talk here, this is the story that's going to help me to communicate the difference. But I have another story. A little Indian Hindu friend of mine who was here in New York for a number of years, he was a very pious Indian. He was a worshiper of Vishnu. And he came to me one day and he said, you know, when I visit a foreign country, I like to acquaint myself with their religion. And he said, so I bought myself a Bible. And I began reading the Bible, starting at the beginning. And now comes the word. He says, I can't find any religion in it. Now, I dared to tell that story after having told Dr. Buber's. This is reciprocal disregard. What is for one religion is for the other not religion. Well, I knew quite a bit about Hinduism. I knew quite a bit about biblical religion. And I said to my little friend, and he was a little chap, I said, well, I can understand that. Because if you don't have the idea that the history of the Jewish race is a religion, is a religious story, but to just the history of that race, well, then there isn't much religion in the Bible for you. When I tell this story to my friends, I like to tell it to them, they say, well, what about the Psalms? Well, from a Hindu standpoint, turn and read the Psalms. What they say for the most part is, God, you're on my side, and you are going to knock my enemies around. And this is just the opposite to what a Hindu would think of as a religious sentiment. In the East, the ultimate divine mystery is absolutely beyond personification, absolutely beyond naming, absolutely beyond categories. You cannot ask, is God merciful, just, wrathful? Does he like these people and not those? This is anthropomorphic projection of human sentiments on an ultimate mystery. But that mystery, which is absolutely transcendent, is the mystery of your being as well. It is completely immanent within you. And you have that saying from the Chandogya Upanishad, Tat Tvam Asi, you are it. But not the you that you name, that your friends like to talk to, that came and went, that you are holding on to, that you are protecting. That is not it. So there's a dual meditation, neti, neti, not that, not that, not anything I can name. And when you have erased everything about yourself that you cherish, that you would protect, you come to the realization of your identity with that anonymous being, which is the being of all things. And the gods, who are simply personifications for your thinking, they don't exist. Personifications of the powers of nature are personifications of those same powers because you are a thing of nature within yourself. I remember a talk by Suzuki once where he started by contrasting the Western with the Eastern point of view with respect to God and man and society. And this is the way he started. Man against God. God against man. Man against nature. Nature against man, God against nature, nature against God. He said, you've got these things split apart, split up. In the East, these are all phantasmagoric reflexes of that ultimate mystery which transcends all and cannot be named. but we've named our God. The aim of these Oriental religions is to experience your identity with that which is the ultimate mystery of all being. Your identity with it, not as a concept, I can deliver that to you here, but to have an experience and a realization deep within you of your identity with that divine power, and then to move and live on that. The word Buddha simply means one who has waked up to the fact that he is that divine Buddha consciousness, basically, and that his value is his power to radiate that consciousness. Just as the value of a bulb is the power to radiate light, so is that our value. And what's important about the bulb isn't the glass, it's the light. And what's important about us isn't the body and the nerves, it's the light that shines through them. And when you live for that instead of for protecting the bulb, you are in Buddha consciousness. We don't have that idea. In the biblical religion, God made the world, God made man, and they're not identical. In fact, the preaching of identity is the prime heresy in this tradition of ours. When Christ said, "I and the Father are one," he was crucified for that. When Halaj, 900 years later, said the same thing in Islam, "I and my beloved are one," he was crucified for that. Whereas that's the whole point in the East. So what do our religions ask for us or give to us? Not the experience of identity with God, because that is the heresy. That's the mystical thing, and that's why our religions are afraid of the mystic. He comes out with this realization. In our religions, we are given a chance to relate to God, a relationship to God. And how is the relationship established? Through a certain, specific, holy society. In Judaism, God has a covenant with a certain people. How does one become a member of that group? It was defined yesterday and printed in the papers this morning by being born of a Jewish mother and by honoring the covenant. And nobody else is in on that. And that is the only relationship to God that God himself has initiated and cherishes. And in the Christian religion, what is it? Christ is true God and true man. That's supposed to be a miracle here. In the East, that's true of everybody. So this is incarnation number 9,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, relates us to God. Well, how do we get in relationship to Christ? Through a social order, through baptism, through membership in his church. Again, a social situation. Our whole introduction to the images, the archetypes of the soul of mythology is through these two claims of two social groups, and both of those claims have been disqualified today, and everybody knows it. Now, that duty concept in the Orient means duty as given you by your caste. Arjuna was a noble, his duty was to fight. In the West, we don't think that way anymore, and this is why the Oriental guru concept doesn't quite work here and can't. Our notion of a mature individual is of a person who does not accept the sheer dictates of society as a child accepts them from a parent, but one who, through his own judgment, and I mean experienced judgment, not simply having gone to the freshman class and heard that this is good and that's bad and then coming out on Professor Bebop's side, but through your own experience to have come to a mature judgment, a value judgment, you are then to work in terms of your own self-responsible judgment. And duty here does not mean what it means in the Orient. It does not mean accepting what's given to you. It means evaluating, developing an ego principle, which is the principle of observation of the empirical environment, your relationship to it, and making a judgment. That, in the East, is anathema. Just as here, in our religions, the notion, I am the eternal, is the great negative thing that we don't recognize, so in the East, the idea of the individual with a peculiar destiny of his own is a concept that does not exist. Freedom, the word freedom, moksha, in Sanskrit, means freedom from being anybody, liquidating your ego. Our idea is not liquidation of ego. Our idea is dissociating the ego principle from the little pleasure principle and having it objective and transcending egoism through the judgment of your ego function. Quite different idea. Now, many of my professor friends tell me students these days, they don't want a teacher, they want a guru. The guru accepts responsibility for the student's life, for the student's moral life. The student tries to be like the guru. Well, I answer my professor friends and say, no, that isn't true, because they don't have the virtue of an Oriental student. The virtue of an Oriental student is Shraddha, absolute faith in the guru. I said, I've never taught a student west of Suez who had absolute faith in his professor. Criticism, judgment, that's what we ask for, and the student brings it. So this is a more complicated situation than that other. Nevertheless, reading these Oriental works, coming in touch with that Oriental world, awakens in us the notion of how the inward way can be followed, how it can be brought forward, up into action. Now, approaching my conclusion, I have one more little anecdote, and this is again about East and West, and it's the clue to how the East can really talk to us in what seems to me to be a most instructive way. I was over in Japan at a big congress, an international congress for the history of religions, and one of our leading philosophers here in New York, a charming gentleman who knew very little about the Orient, but he was over there to represent the West, he had gone with us to many Shinto rites, the Japanese Shinto religion. And he had visited many Shinto shrines. And in the Congress were many Shinto priests, one named Hirai, a very learned and wonderful gentleman, spoke English very well. And our friend said to him, he said, you know, I've been to a good many of your ceremonies now, and I've seen a good many of your shrines, but he said, I don't get the ideology. I don't get the theology. Well, Japanese don't like to disappoint you. And so here I just went, we don't have ideology. We don't have theology. We dance. Now, what that means is that they have gone past the concept system, and that's what we've got to do. They've gone through that to significant imaging. And the art image transcends meaning. You ask any artist, what's your picture mean? And he'll give you a look. It's it itself. If that doesn't talk to you, you haven't got your wires right. You don't ask what a dance means, you enjoy it. You don't ask what the world means, you enjoy it. You don't ask what you mean, you enjoy it. But it's all horrendous, you know that too. Life eats life. Life is terrific. And that is all part of the joy of it. It's through your active imagination that you bring up out of your abyss those concepts which you meet in dream and vision. Bring them into your life while you hold yourself to the world in which you are. You may break off temporarily for the purpose of getting deeper in touch, but anyone who breaks off with the thought of not coming back has really lost the boat. He can flounder. He can go up to Connecticut and buy a dog and a pipe and do little pictures and then think 10,000 years from now, these will be discovered and these will be the ones. This you can do, play that game. But to be in the play of this wonderful moment. And now, to conclude, I want to give one more Indian myth, and it's a myth that has to do with the nature of life. Shiva, the great god, had a beautiful goddess as his spouse, Parvati. And a demon came to him one time and demanded Shiva to hand over Parvati to him. Well, all Shiva did, he didn't say a word, he was speechless. He just opened that eye in the middle of his forehead and poof, a lightning blast came out. And there was on the scene another demon who had come out of the blast. This was a lean demon with a lion-like head and hair waving to the quarters of the world. And his nature was hunger. And he was there to eat up the first demon. Well, the first demon thought, what do I do now? And so he threw himself on Shiva's mercy. Now, when you throw yourself on a god's mercy, that god's got to take care of you. So the god had to take care of Shiva, to take care of the monster. And so the hungry monster said, well, whom do I eat? And Shiva said, eat yourself. So indeed, he started to work. He started with his feet, and he came right up the line, and his teeth went chopping right through his belly, right on up through his neck, until all that was left was a face. Shiva was enchanted. This was a perfect image of life, which lives on life, and the monstrous, horrendous aspect of life. And this mask, which is all that was left, Shiva said, I will call you Kirti Mukha, face of glory. And you will sit above the door to my temple. And anyone who doesn't worship you, anyone who doesn't admit life is monstrous and glorious and can't be changed, that's the way it is, can't come to knowledge of me. The first point of knowledge and illumination is the recognition of the world as is. And then it's this golden, golden world. And people who think, oh, correct the world first, and then I'll be illuminated. Then I can get my own psyche. I mean, the sort of thing that Lange is saying, correct the society and then correct yourself. All societies are evil. All societies are sorrowful. All societies have inequities. But your point, your main point, is to be illuminated. Recognize things that way. Then go to work if you want, but that's the first recognition. Now, this is the great lesson. The horrendous nature of life and the glorious character of it in that monstrous Kirti Mukha. Over the shrines, you can't really know the god till you know that, recognize it, and humbly pass through it.
You've been listening to Confrontation of East and West in Religion, the third talk by Joseph Campbell in the series entitled Inward Journey, East and West. This recording was authorized by the Joseph Campbell Foundation and produced by Electronic Educational Programs. Our theme music is by Acoustic Alchemy. For more information on the work of Joseph Campbell, please call the Foundation at 1-800-330-MYTH, 1-800-330-MYTH. M-Y-T-H, or you can contact us on the World Wide Web at jcf.org. I'm Maura Vaughan. Thank you for listening.